Hello there. This is Keith Bennett. I'm here with Corey Haynes at the Dulles Hyatt on August 18th, 2011. And Corey and I are going to talk about Corey's interesting experiences and adventures.
All right.
So tell me about the beginning, Corey. You had such an exciting and interesting life wandering around the country, meeting people, pairing with them, and what was that like?
Well, it was wonderful because, you know, having the opportunity to spend time, you know, even if it was just a day or, you know, a whole week with a wide range of people of experience levels, of personality types, of projects, and just sort of being able to drop in on one place, pick up some stuff, teach some stuff, go to the next place, teach them what I had learned the place before, pick up some new stuff, sort of almost kind of honeybee it around, you know, dropping pollen here, picking it up over here.
Cool.
There were a lot of different good things about it. Meeting people, building up a network, connecting people together. So I had the opportunity to work at a lot of, you know, spend time at quite a few dev shops. And so I was able to then help connect some dev shops together to, you know, become friends or work together, and ones that knew each other but maybe weren't, didn't know each other as well, but, you know, build up a nice network like that. One of the things that doesn't get talked about a lot but was on my mind from the beginning is that we tend to work in a very insulated community when it comes to our opinion of our skills. So, if you think about the range of people that you actively work with, you have, you know, however many there are, a handful, you know, double digits, say, and you have this view of where you stand. And there's, you know, there's people out there that you look at and you go, wow, you know, they're so much better. They're so great. And then there's people out there that you're like, oh, I'm so much better than them, but you don't know. I mean, you don't know who these people are. You've never really spent time working with them. So being able to go out and spend, you know, effectively 9 months working with a ton of people, it gave me a better sense of really what my skill level was, what was lacking, what I was good at, what I could be better at, what I had gotten better at. And I know it's a great sort of leveling. And so
how did you find people? How did they find you?
So the way I started was I was planning a 3-week trip in December of 2008. And I had been talking to some people I knew who were freelancing and always complained that they didn't have anybody to pair with. And so I was like, man, okay. I got fired from a job in September of 2008. I was like, okay. So I took a little bit of time off, had some money saved up, and was trying to plan the thing, but was having trouble getting people who could. Mm-hmm. Admittedly, it was coming into winter, holidays were coming, so people weren't in the best of positions to have a visitor come in. And then I went to RubyConf in 2008, and I've known David Chalimsky since 2004, and every time we see each other at a conference, we end up pairing together. And so RubyConf was no different. Saw him, what you working on? He's like, oh, our spec, and we sat down and started pairing, and I was telling him about this idea of traveling around, pairing for room and board.
Wow.
And he was like, come to Chicago. He's like, come, I'll be your first person.
Were you not living in Chicago at that
time?
No,
I was living in Cleveland. So I lived in Cleveland from 96 to 2008. And so I was like, oh, okay. So I just today looked on the calendar. It was November 30th of 2008. Packed my car up. I had a little Del Sol, a Honda Del Sol, 2-seater, huge trunk, and got in the car and drove to Chicago. And the week before I was leaving, I got an email from Uncle Bob, or Bob Martin, who I had met in 2004 when he did my immersion training, my XP immersion training. So I had known him, seen him at conferences and things like that. And he said, "Oh, I hear you're coming to Chicago. Come spend a day with me working on what he was working on." So I had like the first week planned. It was a few days with David, day with Uncle Bob.
What were we doing for housing?
So I was sleeping on couches, and so it was all room and board. So my thing was, I want to go pair with people, work on whatever they're working on, and all I ask is room and board. And so.
So you slept on David Chalemsky's couch?
Yeah, he has a futon. He has a wonderful futon. I've now slept on it many times. He has a wonderful futon in his office, and went out there Sunday, got there at like 7 at night or something, and then paired with him for 3 days. 3 days? Paired with him for 2 days, Monday and Tuesday, spent Wednesday, I don't know. It was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Maybe 3 days, a day with Uncle Bob. Mm-hmm. Then when I got to Chicago, and like Monday or so, I got an email from Dave Hoover from Optiva, and he was like, "I hear you're in town. Love to meet you." You know, and I had never met him. We had never met. So I was like, "Oh, great." So I went in. Spent the afternoon with them. And then the funny thing was Sunday, when I was leaving Cleveland, I said, "I may be back Saturday." I was like, I want to be away for 3 weeks, but I might be back Saturday because I don't have any plans. Mm-hmm. Well, by the end of the week, I had the whole 3 weeks planned.
Wow.
Brian Merrick emailed me and said, these people I've known from the Agile community. So I'd been going to Agile conferences since 2004, and knew these people. So it wasn't as though, I'd known them for 4 years. So it wasn't a big thing that, at that point. And so he was like, come down to Champaign. I'm working on my book. So I went down and paired with him for a couple of days.
Is that the scripting of the Ruby book?
No, this was his Ruby Coco. Oh. And he was doing, we ended up working on some drag drop, testing drag drop in Ruby Coco. By the end I had it all planned. So I kept that. So I went from Chicago, stayed Champaign, came back to Chicago, went to Muncie, Indiana, stayed with a guy named Jonathan Branham. Went over to Cincinnati, Columbus. Well, Columbus, then Cincinnati, then back to Cleveland. Mm-hmm. And so, as a long answer to the question, once I started on the road and doing the videos, so I would do video interviews with everybody.
Oh.
So, on my blog, there's video interviews with pretty much everybody I stayed with. And I would just set up a flip camera, and we would talk for anywhere from 4 minutes to an hour.
And what is your site? Your blog site?
It's programmingtour.blogspot.com. If you go to coreyhaines.com, you can get to my blog and all of that stuff. And so I was doing these videos with people. And people started noticing that, hey, there's this guy who's traveling around putting these videos up, interviews. And it was nice because early on it was interviews with Uncle Bob, Brian Merrick, David Chalemsky, Dave Hoover. I think I had a video up with Eric Meyer from Eighth Light. I don't think I had Micah Martin at that time. It was a fun type of thing. And people started noticing and contacting me on Twitter. And pretty much from then on, it was all Twitter. So I started picking up followers on Twitter, people watching the videos, over the course of, it started off where I'd have, 100 people watch the video, and then it got up to, I think at the peak it was, you know, several thousand, which was pretty exciting with, you know, mm-hmm. it was just me sitting there with somebody. So it was all, you know, people would send me emails or Twitter and be like, oh, where are you going? What are you going to do? You know, come to this city. And so I got back to Cleveland and realized that I could keep doing it for a while. I ended up having more money than I thought I did, saved up, and the 3 weeks turned into January. I had a little bit, and then February I went down to Florida, then March came around, and April, and then I planned a three-month road trip. So May, June, and July, I planned, and I drove from Cleveland to Miami to Prince Edward Island.
Whoa.
Back to Cleveland. So 6,900 miles in the 3 months.
What's the river community like in Prince Edward Island?
Well, J.B. Rainsberger is there.
Oh.
I went up to visit him for a week. He's one of my, you know, dear friends and ongoing mentors. Wonderfully insightful, great thoughts on design. I've learned a tremendous amount from him. And he and I, through the years, I met him in probably 2005 was when I had met him. But at conferences and things, he and I had talked about the idea of traveling for a ribbon board. Just going and programming with people for it. Why not? Mm-hmm. But neither of us could, you know, we're in situations that we could do it. And so when the time came, I did it. But JB has been a huge mentor for me. And so I got to go spend a week with him up in Prince Edward Island. Wow. Wonderful time. Wonderful time. And then drove back through Maine and back to Cleveland, basically. Hit Boston, and then it's 90 the whole way back. Actually, no, I went down to New York and over through Pennsylvania.
It's interesting how that whole journey started with what most people would consider a negative event.
Getting fired.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, people have mentioned that, and it was time for me to leave the company. I mean, I had only been at the place for 7 months, 6 months, 6 months. And I just didn't fit in their culture.
Mm-hmm.
And I always tell people that if there's, you know, people ask me, what if you have that one person who's not fitting in? Mm-hmm. And my response is always fire them. Because you're not doing anybody any good having somebody who is effectively poisoning the environment. Doesn't say anything bad about them or anything. It's just, if they don't fit in, mm-hmm. then they don't fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And especially at a small, you know, at a startup, at your, you need to move at a certain pace. And if you have a squeaky wheel, get rid of them. So I got pushed out. And mm-hmm. what I think immediately shifted it was that I got fired. I had gone in at like 7 in the morning to start working. Nobody else was there. When the, I don't know if he was CTO at the time. Yeah, he was a CTO at the time. Got in, calls me into the back room. It was just me and him and who was effectively HR. And they say, you know, we gotta let you go, all that. And so I got home before anybody else was in the had made it to the office. And so I, you know, kind of packed up my stuff, went home, and was like a little bit numb. Because I've been fired before, but not, I mean, it was a little bit, it was weird. But I put on Twitter, well, I got fired, I'm, you know, there. And within about 3 or 4 hours, I had a handful of job offers.
Wow.
Or not like contracts on the table, but hey, we'd like to talk to you. Hey, what do you think? And nothing, there was nothing definite, but you know, a couple people that I really respected had emailed me and said, "Hey, what's your phone number? I want to talk to you and have some of their people, you know, talk." And so the support that I got was such that, you know, within a couple hours, the numbness had worn off, and it was just like, "Oh yeah, this happens." Mm-hmm. You know, it's not the end of the world to get fired. People have different reasons for getting fired, and if you can look at it and go, it wasn't that I was, it's not that I'm bad, mm-hmm. but I didn't either, in my case, I didn't fit in mm-hmm. at that place. For other people, maybe it's they lost interest, and so they weren't doing their best.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, you know, there's a wide range of reasons.
Sure.
You know, maybe the company just had to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can have that perspective, it helps when other people are immediately asking to talk to you. I mean, admittedly,
certainly
that helps.
Yeah.
I mean, I had worked hard to establish a network of people and establish a reputation in the Agile community. And so...
And how did you do that?
Well, I did it by talking to people, shaking hands. I wasn't a big writer, so I didn't do a lot of blogs, things like that. But I went to the Agile conferences, met people, talked to people. And so, like the 2004 Agile, or the XP Universe conference in Calgary was the first Agile conference I went to. And I... on the shuttle there from the airport, I made the decision I was going to shake everyone's hand. And I was shy before. I mean, I wasn't deathly shy.
Corey Haynes, shy?
I mean, that's weird. I wasn't deathly shy, but I wasn't an outgoing person. And I just said, you know what? I can fix that. And so I went, and the first day shook at least half of the people's hands. And at about 6 o'clock, was so utterly drained that I left the conference center, went to the movies. Because movies have always been a place where I go to recharge. And made the horrible mistake of going to see Aliens versus Predators, which I've been waiting for. Awful movie. Horrible movie. And it was like, I mean, it wasn't Star Wars prequels horrible, mostly because I hadn't waited my whole life to see it, but I mean, it was just awful. So that was one thing, but I met everybody there and I talked to them and I forced myself to meet them, and then over the years from then until, you know, 2008, I was always trying to meet people, trying, and even though it was counter to the way I had been, which was more shy, I wasn't, you know, horribly shy, but I became more outgoing,
mm-hmm.
More able to hold a conversation, and then just over time, it changes. I still consider myself an introvert, but from the point of view of you can only go so long before you have to recharge. I recharge my batteries being alone. But I've learned, I guess I've increased my capacitor size. And so I can go for longer periods of time before I'm completely drained. And then I have to, you know, spend a little time.
Mm-hmm. When did you start using Ruby, and what were you using before?
So I spent the majority of my career in the Microsoft ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
So I started off professionally programming in 96, career-wise, like going, getting a job, and went through VB, C#. Started doing Ruby probably the first Ruby I ever wrote was 2006, maybe. Maybe, yeah, 2006 probably. And it was because in the Agile community and at the Agile conference, you started seeing more Ruby coming.
Mm-hmm.
And started seeing Max showing up.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was friends with David Chalimsky. So whenever I'd see him at a conference, we'd end up pairing, and it was inevitably on our spec. So that was the Ruby that I would start to write. And I never did it on my own, really. And then in 2007, yeah, so probably early 2007, I decided I'm going to learn Ruby. One of the things that inspired me was Mike Clark's blog post about using tests to learn Ruby. So he had written a blog post where he had, when he wanted to learn something about Ruby, he wrote some tests that, if he could get them to pass, showed that he understood that part of the language. And it also gives a nice, concise view of what you know about the language.
Was he using RSpec?
I don't remember what he was using. I don't think he was using RSpec. I don't even know if he was using Test Unit.
Mm-hmm.
It may have just been my own assert.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I went through, and I think, in 2007, I wrote at least one blog post, I think a couple of them, which was called RSpec Lunking, where I went through the RSpec source code and started writing commentary on it. And I didn't know Ruby very well, so it was more interesting things I found in the RSpec code.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided I was going to get a Ruby job in probably summer 2007, because I was tired of the Microsoft ecosystem, the tool sets, C#. My style of programming had gotten to where it was cumbersome to work in these languages. And so I wrote a few Rails apps, had a connection with the startup that I ended up joining, and in March 2nd, I believe, of 2008, I started there. Quit my job. I was working at Progressive Insurance at the time. Quit that job in February. Started the startup and never really looked back.
Speaking of .NET, mm-hmm. Where is Iron Ruby these days? Is it gone completely?
You know what? I don't know. Microsoft abandoned it, and there was a community sort of rising for a little bit to maintain it, and I think the Mono guys picked it up, but I don't know where it ended up. I used to keep sort of a little bit of tabs on it through a friend of mine, Will Green. He used to post it. He's Hot Gazpacho on Twitter, and he used to post. He was involved. He was excited about it, and so I would kind of watch what he had to say about it. But I haven't heard about Iron Ruby in a while. Who knows?
So about your travels and about all the many different people and development shops you've been to, you must have learned an awful lot about different ways of doing things and what ways worked and what ways didn't and how people interacted. And
mm-hmm.
What kind of insights can you give us on that?
Well, it's a big question. Small teams. An interesting thing I will mention is that the shops that I found that worked really well, the ones that impressed me the most, were the ones that had sort of internalized XP, extreme programming, and they had internalized the practices. They had internalized the feedback loop, the adapting, the realizing that when you have a problem, you need to fix it. And more often than not, fixing it is by eliminating process than it is adding on process. And so you if that's your default action, is to cut process down, figure out what's causing the pain, and cut that out. Maybe something comes to replace it, but to streamline the situation.
So when you say process, do you mean, for example, putting a bug in Jira, that kind of process?
Or? Yeah, something like that. So suppose you are having trouble keeping track of your bugs, and you're using Jira, but you're just, they're getting lost. So it's like, huh, well, why don't for a little while we stop using Jira and start using a whiteboard and see if that helps? It may not be the final solution, but let's cut things out. And eventually you might move back there, but figure out what the problem is. Don't tack on, so it wouldn't be adding a process where you suddenly twice a day have to check Jira. It's, well, if we're not checking Jira, then there's something else maybe that we could do. Why aren't we checking Jira?
Or maybe we're not using it the right way, or the
maybe
right way that's best for us.
Yeah. Okay. And so small teams, and these companies, what I like to say is that they stopped being agile and just started being software developers.
Say more about that.
Well, it's like when you're trying to be something, then that you're bringing in techniques, you're bringing in process, and you're trying to do this. But most of the companies that I really admire, they just, and I like to say, they don't call it agile, they call it software development. So for the techniques that XP has, they wouldn't dream of not doing automated testing. Mm-hmm. Because that's irresponsible for your client. Now, they do it, and they learn about it. They find pain points with it. And instead of abandoning it, they inspect it. Are we potentially doing it wrong? Are we potentially doing it, you know, in an immature fashion? Are we doing it in a way that we could fix? And so they're constantly inspecting. And, you know, there's the whole inspective app loop. But they look at it, and it's just like, we don't need to be trying to do something. We just need to look at what can we do to give the most value to our clients. And we hire good people who are willing to do that. And so it's just, that's the way you develop software.
So relying on people's intuition and what they've internalized, their native skills, that requires, as you say, hiring the best people and hiring pretty experienced people, I would think, too?
A lot of them, but you can bring inexperienced people in, but don't put them in a corner and have them sit there hacking out code. Bring inexperienced people in and treat them as equals. Treat them as people that you're mentoring. Treat them with respect, and they'll strive to do that. And if they don't, you cut them. You know, I mean, if they're not that kind, then you get rid of them. And you bring in the people who are of that nature. And it doesn't mean that they have to be incredibly experienced. But they need to be the people that can work in a team. Software development is a very social activity. So, like, I'm not impressed by people who sit there and want to put on their headphones. Sometimes you need to. Sometimes you want to just put on your headphones and write code. Not to get into that, you know, wonder, you know, that the zone, but just because, you know, sometimes you need a little bit of time by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, it should be active, team-oriented programming. And when...
What is the most effective way of doing that, of collaborating? What have you seen to be the most successful?
I think the most effective way, which does not mean it's the only effective way, is big open room, big huge monitors, live input devices for everybody. So two keyboards, two mouse on a machine. Interestingly, I've seen both situations where there's one monitor that people are sharing, and I've seen where there's two monitors side by side that are mirrored. And so you're looking at you, you're in front of your monitor, but the person right next to you is looking at their monitor, same thing, mm-hmm. and you're right next to each other. Mm-hmm. Co-location, I'd be surprised if anybody argued that it wasn't the best. I won't say that you can't be effective remote or anything like that. I don't know. I don't have enough experience with that. But the best is co-located, where you're both just writing code together. And you're talking, and you can hear stuff that's going on around you. And it's a very relaxed environment. A couple things that I noticed that I really liked is the companies that ate together, that would either bring lunch in or people would go out and bring it back. Or they would go out in groups of six or something. But if you eat together, it just was wonderful because you got in the morning and it was your family that you spent the day with. And you really, I mean, it was those places I loved. And it just breeds that excitement about it. And it breeds responsibility. And the better you know your teammates and the more affection you have for them, the less you want to let them down. And you're willing to work on your own skills so that you don't let them down.
You really feel like a team.
Yeah, you feel like a team. Crazy idea.
Any suggestions about how to best decide who to pair with when?
Not really. I think it's all just the team learns. Mm-hmm. A team learns who is awake in the morning, who's awake in the afternoon. Different people have different cycles. I tend to be a morning person. So generally by 7 or 8, I'm awake. But I know people who that would be just disaster for them. They're awake by, I know people who are awake by 10. I know people who are awake by 1. I don't think David Chomsky ever sleeps. So, he'll be, I don't know. He's funny like that. But, I think you just find that. But I've had times where I've paired with people who were not morning people, but it was in the morning. And it was just fine. Help them, you feed off each other's energy. Mm-hmm. So, you could just learn it. A team, and if the team knows each other well, mm-hmm. they learn those things.
Have you encountered people on these teams that resisted pair programming?
I've encountered those people. Mm-hmm. Most of the companies that I have spent time with don't have people like that, because they mm-hmm. it's sort of instilled in their culture that a certain right. percentage of the time you're going to be pairing. Mm-hmm. And so you get used to it. And you learn, you build up that skill. It's not an easy skill. And I've met people who resist it. A lot of the time, it's because they've never really had an effective pairing session. So they're told, you must pair program. And for however many years before, they've been solo hackers. Put on the headphones, get in the zone. Oh, I'm up till 4 in the morning cranking out code that generally needs to be rewritten. But they're up there, and I need to get in the zone. And I can't do it if I'm with somebody. And a lot of times when you have them sit down and have an effective pair session, they may not be sold as this is the way they want to do it 100% of the time, but they'll learn, oh, okay, I can see you can be productive, you can write good code, you can do all of these things.
I wonder if some of those bad experiences might be in environments where they've said, okay, we're supposed to pair program. Let's all pair program starting tomorrow and put two people together, but they don't really know how to interact.
Yeah, I was, you know, I've been at, you know, with the trainings I do, everybody pairs during them, and I'll wander around and see people who don't talk. Like, you'll see a pair, and one person will be sitting there, and they're just writing away, and they're like, oh, well, yeah, you know, and start typing again. And then just be like, well. And the other person, the person sitting next to them, like, looking at them, I have no idea what you're even thinking about. Mm-hmm. I don't know what problem you're trying to solve, why you're pausing. And so it's a matter of bringing out that you've got to switch from your internal monologue to an external monologue, and hopefully an external dialogue with your pair. So if you just tell people, okay, you've got a pair program, and you put them next to each other, and they've never done it before, there's a good chance that they're not the kind of person who has ever thought about vocalizing their thought process. Mm-hmm. And if you can't do that, what are you going to do? You're just going to sit there and you're going to bore the hell out of the other person. Mm-hmm. And then there's going to get a bit of friction or animosity, because you're also probably going to be typing. So your pair partner just sits there. Next thing you know, their phone's out. They're checking Twitter. And then you've lost the pairing. Mm-hmm. And then that person may as well be at their own computer.
Sure.
But
how about the places that you've encountered that have been most productive and successful? Mm-hmm. What are the leaders like? The people that kind of make the decisions about how the community will go and what kinds of work day and arrangements they'll have?
I think they all seem to be very engaged. They all seem to like the people. They want the people to be happy, and they tend to be engaged in the day-to-day stuff. Either they're actually sitting on the floor with the people working, or they are in there a lot, or they're in the meetings a lot. But they tend to be very engaged, and have a good philosophy about both software and people.
What happens when a team needs to learn a new technology to do their job? How do they approach that most effectively?
I guess I don't know. I can't say I know how most effectively to do it. Mm-hmm. Some effective ways I've seen to do it is to set aside time to really focus on practicing it. And literally practicing it. So I'm a firm believer that if you're going to learn a new technology, you should not be getting paid to learn it at the beginning.
Hmm.
So that the company wants to learn the new technology, the individuals who are there might be getting paid. But I have a thing against companies and individuals who charge their clients money before they have a good, solid understanding of a technology. Now, there's a difference between, like, a technology such as we're going to switch to be using Neo4j, a graph database, where there's a precedent for it, as opposed to, wow, we really want to learn Clojure. So we're going to take on a Clojure project, or you're a company that all of your people specialize in PHP, and you go, we're going to take on Rails contracts, and our people are going to learn Rails. And it ends up just being a mess for the clients. And I don't agree with that. So if a company needs to learn something significant, take, you know, over the course of a couple weeks, if you want to become a Clojure company, over the course of I don't know how long, but let your people, give your people the time to practice, throw away, read code, talk to people who know what they're doing and do a lot of research into what are the idioms, what are the things I'm going to run into, so that when you do get a client for that, you're not figuring it out. I mean, you'll still be sort of beginner level at it, but you won't be, you know, wrecking havoc through their system. You'll at least have a little bit of a basis. How long do you need? I don't know. I mean,
it depends
on that, and I'm not going to presume to say for everybody. But take some time to learn it, practice.
I've been in situations where I needed to learn a new technology, and I would approach it by, rather than retrofitting our whole complex infrastructure with this new technology, I would, as you say, practice it. But I've been told, you can't do that. You're not working on the client's work.
Mm-hmm,
you
mm-hmm.
have to, because they weren't willing to pay for it out of their own budget
at
the time to learn. So,
yeah. And that's, I mean, the good companies will.
Mm-hmm.
I think that an awareness has to be spread through the industry that practice is an important part of our jobs and of our culture. So companies that want to have you engaged 100% of the time, never learning anything new, there's a problem there. But if you have a certain amount of time each week, even if it's, you know, it's an afternoon. So if you think about it, if you're contracted with a company, you're working at a company and they're paying you for 40 hours, an afternoon is 4 hours. So what you're asking is 10%. Could you give 10%? Is 10% worth it for a company to improve the skills of the developers and of everybody? I mean, not just developers, but, you know, QA can practice. Everybody can practice. You know, there's all sorts of wonderful things you could do. You could put together a team of, say, a few people with a QA and a business analyst, and over the course of a month, spend an afternoon a week building another product. Something very small.
Good point.
And what you're practicing is the team. You're practicing how to figure out what to build, building it, testing it, all of these things. And it doesn't have to be something that you're going to sell, but it gives you that opportunity to see what works, what doesn't work in a safe environment. And, you know, with the intent that at the end you throw it away. Maybe you're just building, you know, a tic-tac-toe game, but you're still practicing how to do it so that when it comes time and you're performing, you can actually, you've already practiced this. You don't have to think about it as much.
Sure. I think of it like math. You wouldn't think of learning math without exercises.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. You know, you have to go through those drills.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the analogy that I used that I was the, you know, imagine if you go to a concert with a band and the only time they ever play their instruments is on stage. You probably wouldn't go see them again. You definitely wouldn't fill the, you know, an auditorium to go see them or a stadium to go see them. You know, I guarantee you that bands practice. And that's, you know, we need to do that as well. Companies need to realize and fund that, because they then can get more productivity. They can get more. The developers are just going to do better for them
if
they get that opportunity to practice.
So, Corey, where are you now today? What are you doing?
Well, I live in Chicago. I've lived there. I moved there about a year and a half, about 2 years ago. I've got a couple different things that I'm doing right now. I have a startup that I'm working on with my girlfriend Sarah called Mercury App, and it is an application to help individuals and teams make better decisions by tracking how they feel about things over time. So you sign up, you put certain topic, and then every day you get an email that says, how do you feel about this? And you can leave a little note, so you can treat it like a journal about topics. So we work on that. We have a couple other little side projects that we're doing as well. I'm also, as a business, doing internal training at companies that really focuses around this idea that you need to take time and practice. So I started in the beginning of 2009. I began doing these weekend community events called Code Retreat, which was about just the idea of what happens if you take away the pressure to finish and really just focus on the fundamentals and get better. Sort of I used to say it was the equivalent of doing scales, and then somebody mentioned to me that it was more like the equivalent of doing small etudes in music, of a small piece. And so the training sessions I did for about 2 years, from 2009 till early this year, traveling around the world, basically doing these events, and sort of molding, evolving the format of it, figuring out what's the most effective format and how to do it. And then maybe 5 months ago, I guess, I felt comfortable enough with my understanding of the format itself to bring it inside companies as actually training. So nowadays I do two different types of training. One is based on this Code Retreat format, and one is a intermediate to advanced test-driven development training, which is, I hesitate to call it a training as much as a test-driven development practice session. So through my travels and discussions and learning from people who are very good at it, I've picked up several practices and several exercises that can be used, and I put them together into a day of here's ways to get better at test-driven development. And so that's another training I do. And it's sort of a very much based on my learnings from the Code Retreat format of what's a good way of getting people practicing, and then bringing in practices that are focused on TDD. And so, yeah, I travel around, and that funds my startup, which I'm bootstrapping. So,
how about for companies that want to create a culture of testing and who are just beginning? It seems like one day would be nowhere near enough.
One day is nowhere near enough.
Yeah.
And so, like, my training is very much kind of intermediate to advanced.
I see.
I have done intro to TDD trainings before, and occasionally I'll do them. But there's lots of people out there who are doing really effective introductory trainings, but there's a lack of, once you've been doing it a little bit, how do you get better? And if you want to sort of instill a culture of testing, I don't really know how to do that. I think it's a very holistic thing of bringing a testing of culture also brings a testing of other things as well. And there's people out there who specialize in coaching organizations and teams out of chaos into something much more disciplined. It's not me. I don't do that. I'm not experienced with that. I'm experienced with teaching developers how to get better, but instilling cultures, I don't do that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for your time, Corey.
Well, thank you so much. It's been fine. Thanks
really
for the beers.
Interesting. You're welcome.
And it's good seeing you again. It seems like we've seen each other a few times, I think.
Yes.
So it's I'm glad you looked me up when I was in town. So
okay, we'll
awesome.
Do it again.
Thanks a lot.
Sure.